Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's elections in Israel that are far from conclusive, since the real politics begin after the election, with coalition building among the small and fractious parties that could take days before there is a clear winner. A veteran Israeli politician who was a leader in the Labour Party and the One Israel Party and was Speaker of the Knesset from 1999 to 2003, Avram Berg, joins us to discuss the neck-and-neck results between Prime Minister Netanyahu and his main challenger, Yitzhak Herzog, of the centre-left Zionist Union, and the last-minute racist warning by Netanyahu that his rule was threatened by Arab voters. Then we'll examine a new report by Sarah Anderson, who directs the Global Economy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies and is the lead author of 20 annual executive excess reports. She joins us to discuss her finding that new figures from the New York State Comptroller reveal that Wall Street banks handed out bonuses last year that are double the earnings of all Americans who work full-time at the federal minimum wage. Her report is analyzed in Tuesday's New York Times by Justin Wolfers, a senior economist at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, who supports the report's stark comparison of income inequality. Then finally, we will look into today's resignation of a rising star in the Republican Party, who was until recently the youngest member of Congress, Representative Aaron Schock of Illinois. Already under investigation by the House Ethics Committee, he has been the subject of recent press scrutiny about his flamboyant lifestyle and the redecoration of his congressional office in the style of the PBS British drama Downton Abbey. Michael Slaughter, a retired English professor in Peoria, Illinois, who recently wrote a letter of complaint about his congressman, Aaron Schock, that was published in the Peoria Journal Star, joins us. And joining us now from Israel is Avram Berg, the son of a Holocaust survivor who has been active in politics as a leader of the Israeli Labour Party and the One Israel Party and was Speaker of the Knesset from 1999 to 2003. He's the author of The Holocaust is Over, We Must Rise from Its Ashes, and is the chairman of Malad, the Center for Renewal of Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Avram Berg.
Thank you very much, Ian.
The election results are just coming in. I take it this is a nail-biter. This is pretty close to being tied, is it not?
Welcome to the beauty of Israeli politics. In the U.S., when the elections are over, you know who is the president. In Israel, when the elections are over, you begin the campaign. So we have a coalition system, which is not a presidential one, and therefore both camps, the major camps, the flagships of both camps, Likud with 27 out of 120 seats, and Labor with 27 out of 120 seats, have now to compile a coalition. We are ahead of us. We have something like three very creative political weeks.
So in terms of Labor's or the new center-left Zionist Union, which is a combination of Yitzhak Herzog's center-left Labor Party and Tzipi Livni's new party. She, of course, was with Kadima and then left that and formed Hatnua, right. So they're going to have to go after Yehel Lapid's Yesh Atid and Moshe Kalon's Kulanu party, along with, of course, Ayman Odeh, the head of Hadash, who also could be an influential kingmaker there. So is that the landscape?
The landscape is such, without mentioning names, because I'm not at all sure that every one of our listeners is there with us, you have two balances of power. The first is central. The central, there are two parties that they can decide between the two of them whether to make king of Netanyahu, to be the kingmakers of Herzog. And the second kingmakers or the second playmakers is the Arab movement. It is to the left of Labor. Still, it has a lot of power. If it will play a neutral game and say, listen, guys, we do not intend to be part of the coalition and therefore do whatever you like. Herzog loses some 13 votes to support him. If they say we support Herzog, he has another additional power. So this is a very, very interesting in which the balance of power is coming both from the right and from the center.
Well, of course, it's no accident that Netanyahu warned, didn't he, just before the election, that the new Zionist Union would be elected by Arab votes.
I really feel bad to find myself in this kind of discussion in which, shamefully, the Prime Minister of Israel, in a almost a semi-racist last-minute desperate call, branded 20% of the population as something not nice. I think it was one of the lowest moral moments of the Prime Minister, and I did not want to go into it. For me, the Arab Party is a very legitimate and good political partners. Every Israeli democracy is and should belong to all of its citizens, and whomever says differently is simply a racist. Nonetheless, the achievement of the Prime Minister, who cannibalized each and every party at his camp in order to narrow the gap between him and Labour, is a very, very personal, impressive achievement.
Well, it seems, though, that Yitzhak Herzog, I mean, he has quite a political pedigree, doesn't he? His father, Chaim, was president of Israel for 10 years. His uncle, Abba Eban, was one of the country's most high-profile foreign ministers. And it would seem, I mean, he's not the most charismatic guy, is he? But he seems to have really connected with the electorate in many ways. Is it largely because of the economic issues?
First, I'd like with your permission to disagree with you. He has a different kind of charisma than Netanyahu. It is not necessarily so that you have, if you have a nice baritone voice and you have a very stylish hairdress, you have a charisma. Herzog is a fantastic political and ministerial operator. He is a very unique, talented coalition builder and agreement builder. And therefore, he simply offers Israel an alternative style to the style of fear and paranoia and hollow rhetoric of Netanyahu. He comes with a lot of hope, with a lot of promises that most of them he can deliver. So it's simply a different kind of leadership, not necessarily compared to equal apples.
Well, that being the case then, Avram Berg, one would think that it wouldn't be so tight. But the general assumption here in the U.S. and amongst political scientists is that Israel has moved considerably to the right. And you could argue that America has, too, at least based on the last elections. But in the last elections here in the United States, the left barely voted at all. I take it in this case, in this election, there's a pretty high turnout. So do you think when the dust settles, there's a chance that Netanyahu will no longer be the prime minister?
You actually put on the table three different issues. Mm-hmm. The first is, I think it's not recommended, at least not for the layperson, to compare the two political systems. In the U.S., the popular vote is not necessarily the majority of the popular vote is not necessarily what brings the president to the White House. And here in Israel, we have a different system. We don't have electoral college, and therefore it's a different system. The second is, it is right that the political some of the political parties and most of the political rhetoric is much more saturated with right-wing, conservative, neocon messages, but it looks, when you look at the blocks of the political blocks, Israel is a split society. It's not necessarily that you have a landslide move from the center to right or whatever. It's a split society with a solid left, solid right, and very solid center. Last but not least, I think the personal achievement of the Prime Minister to narrow the gap in such a short, in the last home stretch of the last week, gives him an advantage that you cannot ignore, and he is now leading by a millimeter, by an inch, okay? He is leading the chance to get the opportunity to form the next coalition. Nonetheless, I believe that still, a national unity government is, as for now, the number one priority of the Israeli president when he will ask each of one of them to form a coalition.
And again, I'd like to remind the audience I'm speaking with Avram Berg, who is in Israel. He's the son of Holocaust survivors, who's been active in politics as a leader in the Israeli Labour Party and the One Israel Party, and was Speaker of the Knesset from 1999 to 2003. He's the author of The Holocaust is Over, We Must Rise from Its Ashes, and the chairman of Malad, the Center for Renewal of Democracy. So then the one comparison surely you can make then, Avram Berg, between the US politics and Israeli politics is the influence of big money and the domination of the media by money and by right-wing billionaires like Sheldon Adelson. I mean, the paper that he's got that's dedicated entirely to Netanyahu has apparently cut into the circulation of Haaretz, etc. So we have...
I don't think so.
Uh-huh.
No. I think that American politics deteriorated from a politics of masses to politics of oligarchs or politics of tycoons. And very few people and a lot of money is dictating the shape of certain, of at least one party in America, not necessarily the other one. In Israel, the situation is different, despite the fact that a lot of money, coming gambling money of Sheldon Adelson, coming through through the venue of a free paper, which became Netanyahu's paper. It is called in Israel the Bibi magazine, the Bibi Ton. Despite all of this, that it could not overcome the vast attitude of people, say, anybody but Netanyahu. I mean, the personal feeling and the personal detest that people feel towards him could not be corrected by any big money. This is a much wider mass feeling.
So, but you do have that dichotomy, do you not, that we have here, which resonated from the Occupy movement, the 99% versus the one. It is a polarized society economically, isn't it, Israel?
It is polarized society vis-a-vis various issues, but I believe that you have to listen not just to the outcome of the election, but to the transformation of the political discourse generally in the last 3 or 4 years. When you listen to Israeli socio-economic rhetorics 5 years ago, it was entirely capitalist, neoconservative, right-wing economic discourse. When you listen to it today, it is much more about the middle class, about the have-not rather than the have. It's against the tyranny of the big money and much more for a much more fair European-style social democrat concept. So the politics of economy is a different one, the rhetoric is a different one, and even Netanyahu will not be able to form a new neocon government. Even his government will be much more social sensitive than the previous one.
So is that to say then that my understanding is that young Israelis, particularly those that are getting married and want to get married and have kids, have a hard time finding housing? Could it be that the influx from the former Soviet Union that supposedly changed the politics to the right, so that was what former President Bill Clinton said, and he got in a lot of trouble for saying that. Is it possible that the younger generation from the Russian emigres are moving back to the left, or that the economic realities are just dictating this change in Israel's politics?
I'm very reluctant to answer your question because, again, when you say left or Democrat in America, it's a comprehensive concept. It's about civil rights and human rights. It's about economy. It's about the role of the government. It's about healthcare. It's about education. It's about the size of the government. It's about the centrality of Washington vis-a-vis the responsibility of the federal states. When you say left and right in Israel, it is mainly and sometimes only about yes or no to the Palestinian issue. And therefore, it is not the same terminology.
I see. Well, but
I'm sorry to be so pedagogical and so educational.
No, no.
I'm very reluctant to answer questions that our audience will understand differently than my intention.
Sure. Well, then let's talk then about the religious vote, because usually the coalitions on the left at least try to make outreach to some of the religious parties. Is that not likely to happen in this coalition building with the Zionist Union? Would they have enough on the center not to have to go and try and court the religious vote?
The natural alliance is between the right wing and the ultra-orthodox religious parties, no doubt about it. Yet they took some vows at while being in opposition at the outgoing Netanyahu's government, saying we shall never go with Netanyahu. Now, saying never was never an absolute commitment for the ultra-orthodox parties. Never is a kind of a relative term with them, okay? So one of the most important efforts done by Herzog now is to cash in their promises during the last 2 years not to go with Netanyahu again. So that will be very interesting.
Well, you know, Avram Berg, I was in Washington just a week or so ago covering the Supreme Court to having another bite at the apple to destroy Obamacare. And it was also the same day that Prime Minister Netanyahu addressed the Congress. And I was driving up on Capitol Hill and I saw this tremendous demonstration of very orthodox, I don't know what orthodox sect they were, but they were holding up big signs saying, Netanyahu, go home. Netanyahu, you don't speak for the Jewish people. Which part of the religious orthodoxy would that group be, do you think?
It was not only them. My daughter, who lives in New York, as an Israeli in New York, demonstrated in front of the Israeli consulate as a secular liberal woman, young woman, carrying the same message. Too many people are reluctant about the kind of expansionism that Netanyahu presents, as if the state of Israel represents the entire Jewish people, because then all of a sudden it says, okay, if Netanyahu's Israel represents the entire Jewish people, does that mean that every Jewish community is up, is the front of Israel and therefore is a fair game for the enemies of Israel? And therefore people say, we are not Israelis, we decided not to live in Israel. We have sympathy, we support, we etc., but we are an independent diasporic entity, and it is across many sectors, not just one specific.
So already the Jerusalem Post is reporting that the gears of coalition building are in motion and that Netanyahu is calling Naftali Bennett to ask him to form a right-wing government. So you were saying that the election is only round one, right, that the real action begins after the election. And it looks like Netanyahu has hit the ground running.
Yes, he hit the ground running, but yes, in Israel, elections are just an introduction to politics.
I see. So when do you think we'll have some clarity? Because this could go on for a while, right?
Within, I think, 10 days or a couple of days, the president has to appoint one of the candidates to try to form a coalition, who then has 3 weeks, 3 weeks to exhaust his chances, then another round of 3 weeks. It can last as long as almost 2 months or whatever, or 6 weeks. But I think we shall know within a week or 10 days whether there is a clear-cut direction or we are into a limbo.
Well, but as of now, Avram Berg, it does appear that Netanyahu has gotten 27 seats, that he's actually gained some seats by devouring other parts of the Israeli right. So he's done better, but the Israeli right hasn't done better. Is that your understanding?
I mean, no doubt, but if I like to use the language used at the right in Israel, so helped us God.
I see. So, well, I guess we have to end on that note and just stay tuned, right?
I'm here.
All right. Well, if you don't mind, I'll call you back in a day or so, and we'll catch
up. Please do.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Avram Berg, the son of Holocaust survivors, who has been active in politics as a leader in the Israeli Labour Party and the One Israel Party, and was Speaker of the Knesset from 1999 to 2003. He's the author of The Holocaust is Over, We Must Rise from Its Ashes, and he's the chairman of Malad, the Center for Renewal of Democracy. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into a new report that finds that Wall Street banks handed out bonuses last year that are double the earnings of all Americans who worked full-time at the federal minimum wage.
מפנה מקום בבטן שאוכל לבלוע אותך אני מפנה מקום בתיבה למכתבים שלך
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sarah Anderson, who directs the Global Economy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Sarah is a lead author of 20 annual executive excess reports and serves on the Investment Subcommittee of the U.S. State Department's Advisory Committee on International Economic Policy. She is a co-author of the Institute's 20th anniversary executive excess report, Bailed Out, Booted, and Busted. And her books include Field Guide to the Global Economy and Alternatives to Economic Globalization. Her latest article at ips-dc.org is three charts that show just how much Wall Street bonuses swamp low-wage worker pay. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sarah Anderson.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And your report, which was analyzed by the New York Times on Tuesday, and they agreed with your findings, reveals that new figures from the New York State Comptrollers reveal that Wall Street banks handed out $28.5 billion in bonuses to their 167,800 employees last year, and that's nearly double the combined annual earnings of more than 1 million full-time U.S. minimum wage workers. So that is pretty shocking.
It was, and it's sure not hard to get people's blood boiling over Wall Street bonuses. You know, it's 6 years now since there was a raise in the minimum wage, and yet this Wall Street bonus culture that contributed to the financial crash in 2008 is stronger than ever.
And do we have any idea of what the base pay for Wall Street workers are, you know, irrespective of the bonuses?
Right. Yeah, it's important to point out the bonuses are just the extra reward on top of base salaries, and those average about $190,000 a year. So all combined, they far outstrip pay in any other part of the economy in New York. And what I wanted to do with the report also was just go beyond the comparison to talk about what it means to have so much money going to the top. Because when these bonus numbers come out every year, there tends to be a lot of celebratory press coverage that it's good for the local economy in New York because these guys who get the big bonuses are going to go out and throw that money around on expensive parties and paintings and so forth. And so what a boost it'll be to the rest of the city. And what I wanted to do was talk about how much more of a boost we would be getting in our national economy if that kind of money was instead going into people at the bottom end of the income scale, because people earning minimum wage have to spend nearly every penny they make to meet just their basic needs. And so they have increasing the minimum wage has a much bigger fiscal stimulus effect than increasing bonuses for people on Wall Street.
Well, in your report, you say that the GDP could grow by about $34 billion if the money went to minimum wage workers, as opposed to $11 billion boost expected from Wall Street bonuses.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's a really important point as we get into this very intense battle over raising the minimum wage. Things seem to be pretty deadlocked here in Washington, but these fights are happening and very vibrant in so many cities and states around the country. And to point out to people, this isn't just a matter of fairness and giving people a decent reward and a living wage. It's also about the benefit for the rest of us. When you put money in the pockets of people who have to spend nearly all of it, that is going to ripple out through the rest of the economy much more than handing out more pay to people at the top.
And the people that you're talking about are the people that feed us and take care of the elderly and the disabled. These are people all around us. And what was the figure you gave for the average base pay on Wall Street?
About $190,000.
$190,000, and that is compared to the current federal minimum wage of $7.25 an hour. And there's a movement afoot to raise that to $15 an hour.
Exactly. And, you know, when you think about the jobs on Wall Street that are risky for the rest of us, can, as we know from 2008, actually push our economy over the brink, resulting in millions of people losing their jobs, compared to jobs like taking care of the elderly, like providing food services, why is it that these essential services for our country are so poorly paid? I think we really need to take a hard look at that.
Well, the point is, though, that in terms of the idea that the money will circulate and boost the economy much more than what giving bonuses to Wall Street people to buy paintings and Ferraris, etc. There are, what, 2.9 million restaurant servers and bartenders, 1.5 million home health and personal care workers, and 2.2 million fast food preparations and serving workers in the country, right?
Exactly. And we have a chart in the report that's pretty dramatic, which is I calculated how much would it take to lift each of those worker groups up to $15 an hour. So take, for example, the country's 2.9 million restaurant servers and bartenders. It would take less money to raise all of them up to $15 an hour than the amount that is going into the Wall Street bonus pool, which goes to just 167,000 people. So when you hear people talking about how we can't possibly pay people $15 an hour, you know, are you kidding? That's such a huge raise for people at the bottom. Just, you know, put that in a little bit of perspective. We're not asking for much for people who do such important work.
Well, I think there's also, I think it's fair to compare, as you've done, or we've talked about, you know, rather glibly, the idea that people who actually do real work that help benefits real people, and these are people among us all the time to take care of the elderly and feed us, etc., as opposed to the people on Wall Street who engage in activities that don't produce anything except profit for themselves, and quite often at the expense of the larger public. I'll give you an example, Sarah, that when the Cromnibus bill passed, the must-sign bill last December, Wall Street, through their lobbyists, managed to slip in a provision that allowed the five big banks to speculate on oil futures. And immediately after the president signed that bill, which he did reluctantly, the Citibank bought a huge position, and they've been speculating on the oil market ever since. And oil is at an all-time low and getting lower, yet the prices at the pump don't reflect that. That's entirely, almost entirely due to oil speculation. So it's worse than theft, as far as I'm concerned, if you go to the pump and you pay more, and it's only because a bunch of people are playing games mm-hmm. with the prices, and they don't have any skin in the game. They don't even have to put up any money. It's all a game, just like the high-speed trading, where they put their computers right next to the stock exchange and do these, you know, millisecond trades around the clock, which is actually illegal. It's called front-running. But they do it, and they get away with it, and they make money out of money. So they're making money for doing nothing. And you're making the comparison that all of these people in amongst us who are so poorly paid are actually doing real work and deserve to be, you know, paid at least something resembling a living wage.
Exactly. Well, and Ian, you just opened the door for me to talk about another pet topic of mine, which is we need to tax this kind of speculation. Right now, these guys who are playing around with the oil commodities, futures, and the other complicated derivatives, when they make those trades, that's not taxed. You know, when you or I go to the store and buy a winter coat, or maybe in L.A. you don't need a winter coat. I should come up with another example, but we have to often pay a sales tax on these kinds of things. When the Wall Street traders are buying and selling the derivatives products that have no real value to the rest of us, that's not taxed. And so it's really time to put a small tax on these kinds of financial transactions that wouldn't mean much to ordinary investors and their pension funds, but to these guys who are doing the high-speed trading, that are, you know, doing the short-term speculation, it could really add up, and it could discourage that kind of risky behavior and generate a lot of revenue that we could be putting into things that would benefit the rest of us, you know, investing in jobs, in healthcare, education. And so thank you, Ian, for letting me bring that topic up.
Well, didn't the Europeans pass a transaction tax?
Yeah, well, things are really moving ahead there. Already, the UK has a tax on stock trades, and now 11 other governments in Europe have committed to adopting a financial transaction tax on trades of stocks and derivatives, and they are very close to a final deal on that. And the governments involved include Germany, France, Italy, Spain, so, you know, the major economies of continental Europe. And I think once they start raising a lot of money on that in Europe on a financial transaction tax, it should really boost momentum here. And I think that we recently had the House Democratic leadership come out in support of this, so we're seeing some momentum here, but I'm hoping that when Europe starts implementing it, it'll move things ahead even further.
So in other words, if the sky doesn't fall in Europe, you think there's
exactly
possibility that a few people over here will get the message? Because I mean, Wall Street is not just protected by the Republicans, who obviously passed the Cromnibus, but they had some help from some Democrats. And, you know, Senator Schumer has always been pretty friendly to Wall Street. Mm-hmm. They don't pay any kind of income tax like ordinary mortals have to pay, and people are quite aware of that, I think, as we approach April the 15th. You know, Mitt Romney showed us how little you can pay if you make money out of money.
Exactly. And, you know, I just hope that these people pay attention to the opinion polls time after time. They show that the American people think we should be taxing Wall Street more. They, you know, agree with, you know, many of the progressive proposals around taxation, but these big banks still have huge influence in Washington. I mean, you were talking about Citigroup earlier. Here's a company that would not exist today if it were not for the generosity of the American taxpayer. They were pretty much owned by the taxpayers after the crisis, and yet here's a company that owes its existence to the generosity of American taxpayers, and yet here they are again throwing their weight around in ways that are not in the public interest. So I think people need to keep up the pressure on Congress, and as I said, the opinion polls show that the public would support higher taxes on Wall Street, and we need to hold their feet to the fire.
And again, Sarah, your report that's available at ips-dc.org, 3 charts that show just how much Wall Street bonuses swamp low-wage workers pay, was analyzed in Tuesday's New York Times by Justin Wolfers, who found that the Wall Street bonus pool for last year is roughly double the total earnings of all Americans who work full-time at the federal minimum wage. He analyzed that and basically came to the conclusion that you got it right. And what I find interesting is that the author of the New York Times article, Justin Wolfers, is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics and a professor of economics and public policy at the University of Michigan. And, of course, the Peterson Institute is very Wall Street-friendly. Pete Peterson himself is a Wall Street billionaire who's sort of been on a jihad against Social Security for the longest time, and tells us endlessly that the sky is falling because of the deficits, which have basically become a non-issue. So don't you find that pretty, I mean, that's a pretty decent vote of confidence in your report.
I was very pleased to see that, and I really appreciate Justin Wolfers, who is that senior fellow at the Peterson Institute, for taking a really fair, even-handed look at this and coming down on my side and really validating the research. I think that it does go to show you that even someone like me at the Institute for Policy Studies, that is perceived as a group pretty far on the left in the political spectrum, if you use solid numbers that can't really be disputed, you can be taken seriously in the mainstream media. And I really appreciate the New York Times for taking it that seriously.
And do you think that this issue of income disparity will be an issue in the 2016 elections? I mean, there are a lot of people on the political left in this country are hoping that somebody like Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren run in the Democratic primaries. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty odd situation to have about 20 Republicans and just one Democrat. and that Democrat hasn't even said she's running, although it's probably likely she will. In fact, you know, if she doesn't run, they don't have a candidate. I mean, it's a weird situation, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the word inequality will be bandied about no matter who the candidates are. But the real question is, how serious are they going to be about the solutions? If it's just something mealy-mouthed about giving people a little bit more job training or whatever, that's not going to get us very far. I think, you know, certainly if you had a Bernie Sanders in the race, he is, a really smart and strategic thinker about inequality, and you would hear a lot about some, really serious proposals to address it. And I think it would be helpful to have a range of views like that in the debates. I think it'd be really healthy for the country. They can't get around talking about it because it's really on people's minds. Going back to the New York Times piece, I have heard that this article about the Wall Street bonus report got huge reader interest. So the demand is out there for a debate on this, and the question will just be, how serious is that debate?
Well, but just in closing, Sarah Anderson, it would seem that the fact that we have only have Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren as champions of the average Americans in the entire United States Senate, that's pretty depressing. I mean, without Elizabeth Warren holding the line and holding the feet to the fire, you know, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which she's largely responsible for creating, that wouldn't even happen. They fought that one tooth and nail. They keep watering down Dodd-Frank. As I mentioned, the Cromnibus, the must-pass bill back in December, watered it down and allowed these guys to rip off the every American consumer at the gas pump. So we need a lot more Elizabeth Warrens and Bernie Sanders, don't we?
We do, and I think we do have a few more. I am definitely sad to see Senator Harkin retiring because he has been a real champion of the people for many years. But there are others as well. I would say Senator Sherrod Brown and Whitehouse and Merkley. There are others who I think are solid on these issues. Maybe they don't get quite as much attention, but we, of course, need to continue to build the pressure. That's the only thing that's really going to make a difference. It's not just electing the right person. It's really building the movements that are going to keep them to their word.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Sarah Anderson.
All right, thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Sarah Anderson, who directs the Global Economy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. She's the lead author of 20 annual executive excess reports and serves on the investment subcommittee of the U.S. State Department's Advisory Committee on International Economic Policy and is the co-author of the Institute's 20th anniversary executive excess report, Bailed Out, Booted, and Busted. And her books include Field Guide to the Global Economy and Alternatives to Economic Globalization. Her latest article at ips-dc.org is 3 charts that show just how much Wall Street bonuses swamp low-wage worker pay. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the resignation today of the rising young star of the Republican Party, Representative Aaron Schacht of Illinois. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Slaughter, a retired English professor in Peoria, Illinois, who recently wrote a letter of complaint about Congressman Aaron Schock that was published in the Peoria Journal Star. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Slaughter.
Thank you.
And your letter was obviously, you're furious with this guy, and he's just resigned.
Well, I wouldn't put it as furious, but, you know, when he arrived in the House of Representatives in Washington, he was, in fact, Eric Cantor, who is no longer in Congress because he was dismissed, was called the bright young rising star of the Republican Party. Well, unfortunately, today it appears that his brightness has gone dark because he learned very quickly in the power-laden stratosphere of Washington, D.C., how to take advantage of all the rules and regulations that are supposed to be followed. And I think back on his career, at 18, he entered his first political race and became a school board member, just through write-in. And then he was, I think, 23 years old when he joined the Illinois Assembly. And so he was a new, young legislator who was really going to do wonderful things. And then when, of course, the scandal about his office occurred, he referred to, he said, well, I'm not an old, crusty white man. I'm young, and I have young ideas, and I'm full of adventure, and I want to do things differently. Well, it just so happened that I am an old, crusty white man, and that got to me. And so that prompted the letter, which I sent to our local newspaper, along with many other people. And so we were not so much upset with the color of his office. He can paint his office any color he wants. He can be any color he wants to be. It's just that he needs to be a good legislator and legislate relentlessly and authentically, and he seemed to be spending more time traveling the world with his celebrity friends and then making the mistake as a young man, posting everything on Facebook and sort of bragging about all of his traveling and celebrity events and so forth. All the while, he appeared to be at home because he bragged about being a real estate developer at an early age. In fact, he said he bought his first property when he was 18. All of a sudden, we began to unearth that he's using taxpayer money to do all kinds of things, including making investments with his major donors and flying on their private planes and buying cars from those donors at taxpayers' expense. I guess that's possible in the Congress that you can actually declare that as an office expense. But then he was turning in tremendous mileage that he would drive within his district when he was flying in a private plane and sometimes was only home for a couple of days in the month and was charging over $1,500, $2,000 mileage fees. Well, you know what? All of these things begin to make us realize maybe the farm boy from central Illinois had a little bit of Washington, D.C. power had gone to his head. And, of course, he's been a prodigious fundraiser for the Republican Party and has one of the largest, supposedly, campaign funds at his disposal of practically anybody in Congress. Now, he's only been in Congress, less than 6 years. So he seemed to know how to make money for himself and for the party, but he wasn't always following the rules and regulations. That's the unfortunate thing. And you know what? We're all expected as citizens to follow rules and regulations, and I guess we assume that our elected officials are following the rules and regulations of their whatever they're serving in. So I think we've just scratched the surface of Mr. Schock's corruption. I think there'll be more uncovered in weeks to come. So, unfortunately, his bright star is going to be like a comet falling away.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Slaughter, who's a retired English professor in Peoria, Illinois, who recently wrote a letter of complaint about Congressman Aaron Schacht that was published in the Peoria Journal Star. And today, Aaron Schacht announced his resignation as a member of the United States House of Representatives effective March the 31st. And he is, of course, a 33-year-old. He was the youngest congressman there for a while and a rising star in the Republican Party. But he did seem to have a predilection for luxury goods. He had his congressional offices redecorated in the style of Downton Abbey. He went off doing tango dancing in South America. His social media showed him in the swimming pool with West Point cadets. And of course, he appeared shirtless on a fitness magazine, which his social media activities and his ripped body, which he liked to show off, and swimming in the pool with all the cadets and all this kind of stuff, has led to a lot of sort of buzz in the gay community, who think that he is one of these Republican closeted gays, which shouldn't be an issue. But in his case, if this is true, he is, of course, has been very hostile to the LGBT community as a legislator. Yeah. So is there anything to those rumors?
I think there is, and I certainly am not the one to take the responsibility of outing him, but you know what? My whole thing, or my whole interest in Congressman Schacht was that he would be an authentic representative for Central Illinois, and that he would go to Washington and have our interests at heart and to devote his attention to those responsibilities and duties. But instead, he's kind of shivered away, and when questions were asked about his sexuality, he just wouldn't answer the question. And yet he seemed to have a lifestyle that suggested in many ways that he could be gay. And then, of course, the whole Downton Abbey paint job in his office, and the I don't know whether there was a big bouquet of pheasant feathers, I think, which was what a lot of people said, oh, my goodness, this is too extravagant for a legislator to be having his office done in this particular extravagant style. And so it called forth a lot of detractors who all of a sudden said, you know what, there's something wrong here. And so when you begin to scratch the surface, you find out that he wasn't very authentic in many ways. And that's unfortunate, because what I think government needs more now than ever are bright, young, dedicated, responsible people to come into our Congress and our state legislators and our city councils and provide the kind of energy and the kind of innovation and the kind of if you want to call it, youthful inspiration. But in his case, I'm afraid he used his youth as a calling card to come to Washington, and then he misspent that youthful image in the wrong ways, and he did it to himself. He called the spotlight on himself. I don't think, I think he was, and maybe it's just a sign of the times that young people just have to put everything out there on social media for everybody to see, and it somehow gives them a feeling of achievement. I don't know, but anyway, I think it's unfortunate that his brightness is dulled now, and I think in the weeks ahead and the months ahead, there will be lots of scandal that and lots of irregular and unlawful things that he did as a legislator, and all of this will be revealed. And and so I hope he has plans to hide out someplace for a while.
Well, you know, obviously, whether, as I say, the only relevance to him being gay is his legislative record, which is hostile
exactly.
to gays. But he, of course, posed shirtless for Men's Health magazine,
yes.
And a CBS reporter said that a TV journalist told him he'd walked in on Schock and the TV journalist's roommate coming out of the shower together. But
yes.
that aside, I think the real scandal is that Schock sold his home to a former Caterpillar executive and political supporter for a price well above the market.
Well, he's living in more than $2 million home right now, which went into bankruptcy and then has been sold, but he refuses to move out because he's too busy. And of course, this is just being, you know what, this has been going on for weeks now, and it just shows that his arrogance has overruled his intelligence, I think, at this point. And I think back to, this was back in February when the New York Times actually ran quite a lengthy article about Congressman Schock in their national section of the New York Times. You know what? When you reach that proportion of coverage in the media, they don't do it unless there's something to investigate and something to find out about a particular political person. And they were not kind in what they had to say in a rather lengthy article about Congressman Schock at that time.
So as a constituent, Michael Slaughter, of Aaron Schacht's, who just announced his resignation today, have you ever dealt with him? Have you had any meetings with him?
Yes, well, when he was running, actually, for his school board position at 18 was a write-in vote, but his first elected position was in the state of Illinois legislature, and I live in an older neighborhood which has a very strong residential group. We're a very strong association, homeowners association, and so our local council person, our district council person, had arranged for us to meet this young man who was running for the state legislature, and several other city officials were there. This was at 7 o'clock in the morning at our neighborhood popular restaurant, and we were all there and primed with questions and prepared to meet him. Well, at 7:30 he still wasn't there, and at 7:45 he still wasn't there, and then an hour later, and this was for many of us our first impression of this young man, he arrived with no excuses, coiffed and dressed and seeming to be more concerned about his hair was gelled than what he had to say, and he made a few remarks, and then the group was asked if they had any questions for him, and of course by that time we had all become disenchanted with our candidate for state legislator, and not one person asked one question, and so that was a very, for many of us, and for me particularly, it was a very sour initiation into this rising star in politics. He seemed to care more about himself than he did about the people who were going to elect him. And I think that's what's happened with his very short career in Washington. Too focused on himself and not upon what he was sent to Washington to do. So.
Well, if you say he was perfectly coiffed, I mean,
he seemed to worry more about his hair.
Right. Well, I'm saying, you know, roll call, the Hill paper and the New York Times have called Schock flamboyant. The Guardian,
yes.
in an article
yes.
About this Downton Abbey-inspired office that he had redecorated,
yes.
noted that the decor was dangerously flamboyant. So they're,
yes.
they're certainly talking
in
code there, I would say.
Yeah. Well, in my very short letter that I wrote to our local newspaper, I referred to him, because, of course, it was the Downton Abbey thing, and I just referred to him as the Lord of Gerrish Manor. It was really not done in good taste. It was done extravagantly and elaborately, and certainly not In the style of a conservative. Now, he referred to himself as a conservative Republican. His style was anything but conservative, not only in his office accommodations, but in his personal behavior.
Well, just in closing, Michael Slaughter,
yes.
You know, the Republican governor of the state of Illinois has said this is a sad day. Is there any chance that the Democrats could pick up this seat?
Well, if they can find a good candidate, it's just that Aaron Schock was able to win his last election by 72%, and because there was really no competition. And he has such a huge campaign war chest. And, of course, let's face it, Illinois has been the epicenter of probably the greatest political corruption. When you think how many of our governors have been imprisoned, we have one in prison now. In fact, I can't remember if Governor Ryan has been released from prison yet or not. And so we've had a rather lengthy history of corrupt politics in the state of Illinois. And I think, be very truthful, I think Congressman Schock was supported very much by a former member, governor of the state of Illinois, who raised a great deal of money for his initial run for Congress and has been very, I think, instrumental in consulting with the young congressman and telling him how to negotiate his career into one where he was supposedly set then to run for governor and then senator and then, oh, who knows, but what, there was presidential aspirations there too. He was the golden boy of Illinois Republican politics. And Republican and politics in Illinois has not been very golden. It's been more tarnished, I'm afraid.
Well, Michael Slaughter, I thank you very much for joining us
yes.
here today.
All right. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Slaughter, who's a retired English professor in Peoria, Illinois, who recently wrote a letter of complaint about Congressman Aaron Schock that was published in the Peoria Journal Star. And, of course, Aaron Schock just resigned from Congress today. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Molly Lewis. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The headline written down.